open a book and it invites you to fall in.
That was my North Star. I always sailed towards that star.
I didn't do this so that I could get money or get famous or any of the other stuff. I did it because I love writing. And writing is something that you don't choose. It chooses you.
Welcome to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton. Karen Slaughter's latest thriller, Cop Town, is set in Atlanta in the mid-1970s. Karen Slaughter focuses on the struggles of female police officers at a time when nobody thought they should be on the force.
The men don't want them there. Their families didn't want them there. They were terrified that something awful would happen or that they would be sullied and never marry a good man. And, you know, it was an incredibly dangerous job, not just physically, but mentally, socially.
Karen Slaughter is well known for her debut novel, Blindsided, which was published in almost 30 languages. She is the author of the Will Trent series that takes place in Atlanta, as well as the Grant County series set in rural Georgia. Guest host and fellow crime novelist Elizabeth Bazzelli asks Slaughter if success has changed her.
Well, I'm sure it has, but also I was published before I turned 30.
Yeah.
And just not being before I was 30 anymore changed me a lot. and the characters grew along with me, Sarah Linton especially, because she's the character I've written about in all but two books, or three now with this. And, as I got older, she was much looser about some things. She didn't work out as much. If she wanted cake, she ate cake. She didn't put up with a lot of crap. I think that changed the most. If you want to see how I changed, probably look at what Sarah's doing.
So you think Sarah's kind of followed? So if we follow Sarah, we know what's happening to you then.
Well, except for all the loss and the murder and the tragedy.
I want to talk about Cop Town a little bit here at the beginning. It is a standalone, which means it's not part of your two big series, and it is hot off the presses right now, and we're very fortunate to have you here, and the reviews are great. And if I can give a review, I've read it twice. I absolutely love this book.
Thank you.
I love it because of the depth that you go to and places you take these characters, and I love the characters, they're flawed. Wow, tell us a little bit about Cop Town.
Well, I mean, just in an overall kind of, this is a thriller sort of story, it's about a cop killer, a serial killer. And this was pretty common in the 1970s for people to kill police officers. In Atlanta alone, we had, during that decade, 12 officers murdered. And this was something that happened all over the country. And if you think about the 60s being the screw authority decade, people were actually starting to do something about it in the 70s,
yeah.
In very violent ways. The people who were still caught up in that, and the ones who didn't get a mortgage and have a family and give up on being radicals. So this was a very tumultuous and dangerous time. As far as the structure of the book, you know, it's set in Atlanta in 1974. This is when the city went from being majority white to majority black.
Mm-hmm.
We had one of the first African-American mayors of any large American city. The other one was in Detroit, and he was indicted a year later. And we've had our share of indicted mayors, but this mayor in particular, Maynard Jackson, was a fantastic mayor because he really did not care about color except green.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something Atlantans really can get behind.
Mm-hmm.
He brought in a lot of industry. He expanded the airport. Under his leadership, it became the busiest airport in the world. I mean, it really, he was very vocal getting the Olympics to Atlanta, which
mm-hmm.
completely changed the makeup of the city.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the greatest stories I heard about him was from his widow. And she was talking about the first time he went into the Commerce Club as mayor. And I'm sure there's a similar club here in Traverse City in every town where business is done.
Mm-hmm.
And so he went to this restaurant and he had his staff with him and they said, I'm sorry, sir, but you can't bring the woman in your staff. And he said, well, then we won't do business here. And he turned around and he walked away. Now, many politicians today would say that they would do that, but they actually wouldn't.
Mm-hmm.
And he actually did. And he turned around and walked away and they had to force either go bankrupt or they had to let women in.
So he taught them a new way that he was bringing to the city.
Exactly, yeah.
That's not what came to Detroit, trust me.
No, no. Well, we also had something that's probably one of the most viable industries in the entire world for its addictive qualities, unlike automobiles, and that's Coca-Cola. And that that made a huge difference. And even, you know, in the 1970s, one of my characters in Coptown lives in an area called Buckhead. She grew up there. And this is our really Tony rich people area. We had, in the 70s, it was all old money. Now a lot of rap stars have moved in and people are clutching their pearls over that. But Asa Candler was in charge of the Coca-Cola company. And he really believed in not just philanthropy, but using money to achieve social change.
Oh.
He started the CDC because he noticed that his caddies were all getting malaria from the mosquitoes.
Oh my gosh.
And so it was a mosquito project, basically for golfers. I'm sure there are men in here who can appreciate that. And that eventually became the CDC. He sold that land to the government for a dollar and let them have all the research and, you know. And another thing he did, when I was talking to people from this era, there's this great woman who's 92 years old, and she grew up in Buckhead and was part of that community. And she said, I remember when Martin Luther King Jr. won the Nobel Peace Prize, and everyone was outraged that there wasn't some sort of dinner in Atlanta to celebrate this. And even though everyone was outraged, no one was strong enough to speak up and say, we have to do something.
Oh.
And so Asa Candler called up people and said, I think we should have a dinner. And they had it a week later.
Oh, good.
So, you know, I think that one thing I learned with Coptown is that power is never taken. It's always given.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this is about women who are police officers on the police force when no one wants them there. The men don't want them there. The only thing the black cops and the white cops can agree on is that policing is not a place for women.
Mm-hmm.
Their families didn't want them there. They were terrified that something awful would happen or that they would be sullied and never marry a good man. And, you know, it was an incredibly dangerous job, not just physically, but mentally, socially. You know, they were put into these extreme environments. And I had, as I talked to different people, like this 92-year-old woman and a bunch of retired female police officers, it just gave me such respect for what they had to do and what they had to go through.
Yeah. My grandmother was, well, my father was born in Atlanta, and so my grandmother lived there. And talk about coke, that was at a time when I guess there was real cocaine in coke, and she used to send him down to the store every morning to come back with a bucket of coke. So maybe... That's a different side of coke. I've read your books. I've read just about all of them now. I tried not to get them all mixed up in my head because they're all in there kind of running around. And it just struck me that what you write and with the success you're having, the millions of books that you sell all around the world, this is like the new people's literature. People want to read these books. And it took me back to Charles Dickens in his time, 1900s, 19th century, and how he was born in the lower echelons of London, and he wrote about murder and prostitutes, and they came out in little penny dreadfuls and so forth. But whose books are still selling today? And it's just as though this is what the people want to read, and thank God, people are really reading again.
They are, and they're very bloodthirsty, which is good for our business. But you know, the one thing Dickens did, because a lot of authors, especially what they call literary authors who are out promoting My Navel, Myself, or some other engaging tome, they disdain this sort of thing. And Dickens did performances. He did he would come, if he were alive today, he would be on your wall as someone who's come here and talked about his books.
Yeah.
But back to your comments about people reading this, you know, it's very difficult to name a book that really endures, that doesn't have some sort of crime in it.
Oh, yeah.
Even Gone with the Wind has a murder in it. Scarlet kills the Yankee in cold blood.
Yeah.
And if you read the passage, she talks about how she has this bloodlust and she wants to dance in his still warm blood, and it's very descriptive.
Oh.
And if you're, hopefully you're familiar with the book, there might be some young people who aren't, read the book. And so, you know, that when she shoots the Yankee, you see Melanie Wilkes at the top of the stairs, and this is in the movie too, And before this, Melanie Wilkes is this milquetoast Scarlet can't stand. She thinks she's a weak woman. Mm-hmm. And then Melanie sees that Scarlet has killed someone, and instead of falling apart, she says, "We need to bury the body." And not just that, she says, "Can we check his pockets for money?" And that changes their relationship. And when I write crime stories, I think about that scene and how important it is in the book about these women's relationships, because they really become stronger because of it. And to me, that's the whole point of writing about crime. I never want a book with my name on it where you can take the crime out and the book still reads like a regular book. Mm-hmm. You really need to make sure that it's integrated into the story and that it belongs there. And you're not writing to titillate, you're writing to inform, you're writing to move the plot forward. And I feel the same way about sex scenes, you know? If it doesn't say something about the character, who they are at the point, if it doesn't move the plot forward, then you shouldn't have it there, unless yeah. you're E.L. James.
Yeah. You have two main series. The first one is the Grant County series, and that takes place in a small Georgia town. Mm-hmm. Was that the town where you were born?
Well, it was an amalgamation of the towns I knew growing up. There were three cities, and you know, there was the bad city, and the good middle-class city, and the rich city. Mm-hmm. And I thought it would be really nice to write about that. They always say, write what you know. Mm-hmm. And I thought, you also need to write what you want to know.
Yeah.
And I want to know why crime changes communities. I grew up in a time of the Atlanta child murders. Yeah, I was about 8 or 9 years old. And, you know, for a kid to know that children can be harmed like that was a startling thing in the 1970s. You just didn't hear about that kind of awful stuff. And it changed my life in a really selfish sort of kid way. Mm-hmm. I was really upset because I couldn't go down certain streets in my bike. And, you know, in the summer, my parents used to lock the door. And, you know, if they told us if we got thirsty, there was a hose. And not to come back inside until we'd played ourselves out.
Yeah.
And they didn't do that anymore. They wanted us to stay inside. It really changed my life. And so when I was writing Grant County, I thought, I want to write about that, not just crime, but how it changes people, how it changes the detectives and the doctors and the people who work on the cases. Mm-hmm. And it's a closed-ended series. There are 6 books in the series. And it was really a great experiment for me because, you know, after a certain point, you think, why is anybody living here? They're murderers and rapists and, you know, God, move to Atlanta. You'll be safe there. But it was really great to find my voice in that series.
And then you went on to the series in Atlanta, the Will Trent series. Mm-hmm. Did you feel you had to get out of that small town in order to kind of enlarge your landscape?
Absolutely. And you know, the Georgia Bureau of Investigation is to Georgia what the FBI is to the country. So they can go in any jurisdiction as long as they're asked.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought, well, let me have Will Trent be a GBI agent so I can kill people all over the state. And it's much more believable.
Where did your first novel, Blindsided, come from?
Well, I had my sign company at the time, and I sold it when I got an agent
mm-hmm.
because I thought, this is my chance. I don't want to be a sign maker. I want to be a writer. That was my dream.
Yeah.
And I thought, you know, you can't, I don't want to be looking back and saying, why didn't you try this? Why didn't you put everything into it? So I sold my business, and in return for taking a very extreme pay cut, I worked 4 days a week. And I would get up in the morning and write and go home at night and write. And then on the weekends, I would write. And I was working on a book that was basically Gone with the Wind,
mm-hmm.
Which I didn't realize you probably shouldn't do if you're a writer. it got rejected everywhere. But people said, you know, we like the voice. It's just this book doesn't work for us. We want to see something else.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a conversation with my agent, and she said, well, what do you want to do next? And I said, I love crime fiction. I've always wanted to do that. And she said, try it. If it works out, great. If it doesn't, then try something else. And I wrote Blindsided.
Oh, that's great. That's a great story. And I wanted to find out if you'd ever had a lot of rejections, which I was hoping for, of course.
Absolutely. I've had tons. Yeah, yeah.
So your novels are tough, they're real, they're bloody, they're gutsy, they're all those things, is sex of all persuasions. Do you ever get tired of people asking you, oh, a woman, what do you write this for, when they don't ask that of male writers who write the same things?
It's true. And, you know, I know you've had Mike Connelly and Lee Child here, and I just read, personal, Lee Child's next book that's out, I think, in September. It's fantastic. I love Jack Reacher. But he kills a lot of people, and he breaks a lot of necks, and nobody ever says, oh, gosh, he's so violent, or no one ever says, why do you write about strong men?
Yeah.
But people do ask why I write about strong women, and they say, as a compliment, you write like a man.
Oh, no.
Which I get that a lot.
You write like a woman.
Well, exactly. And the fact is that 83% of all book buyers, as you know, are women.
Yep.
We've been reading this for a really long time. I think that it's mostly men who are shocked and a little concerned that we really like these books. And, you know.
Do you think it scares them?
I don't know. I think some it must, but you must have, when you're at a signing, sometimes a man will come up to you and say, I don't read books written by women.
Yeah.
And you just say.
And I just say, why?
Right. Well, gee, what are you missing?
Yeah.
But it's interesting, because if a woman said that to a man, then you would just assume she was weak and, or ball breaker.
Oh, she couldn't take it.
Right. Or she hates men, or, you know, all these horrible things. But a man, you just think, meh. But it really is an interesting dynamic. I can't complain too much, though, because I get a lot of attention for it.
Yeah.
And when I first started out, you know, I love Sarah Paretsky. I love Kinsey Millhone, Sue Grafton, Sandra Brown, all these great women who are writing stories, but they're lighter stories than what I write. I think that's a fair statement.
Yeah.
And when I started writing, it was Patricia Cornwell, Kathy Reichs, and me.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody was looking at us funny.
Mm-hmm.
And so now I think it's really great that women can write these stories, and you know people are really happy about it.
Not to have boundaries around what you can do.
Exactly.
Or try to do.
Exactly.
Oh,
one thing I do get asked about the Stieg Larsson books a lot.
Oh, yeah.
Because
I think I ask you about
he's
that.
He's hailed as this great feminist because he created this character who is a strong woman who does things men want strong women to do.
Mm-hmm.
Like she doesn't feel fulfilled until she gets breast implants.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that sort of thing, I think, disqualifies
you. I have a feeling you're not going to have a breast implant in your book.
No, well, let's please not talk about my breasts there. Thank you. But, you know, as a woman, I think what bothers me is when men get really raised up for writing about strong women.
Yeah.
Because women have been doing it forever.
Yeah.
I mean, Flannery O'Connor. Oh, Mary Shelley. You can go back in time. And there are just so many great women writers. But when women write about women, they're writing cozies, or they're writing chick lit. And when men write about families and struggles and things, domesticity and that, they're writing really important literature.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a big difference.
Oh, yeah. And women are limited, too. So many women try to do other things, but they're put in those little boxes of writing the cozies or writing something light, not what you get to write.
Yeah. I feel really lucky. You know, I remember my first signing, and you probably get this. Someone comes and says, hey, do you remember me? We went to high school together.
Mm-hmm.
And you think, well, there's a reason why we didn't talk after high school. This woman came to me, and she said, do you remember me? We were in kindergarten together. And I thought, that's just not fair. And she said, I remember you, because when the teacher came around and asked us what we wanted to be when we grew up, and the teachers in here know that you're looking for ideas, you don't care what the kids want to be. But she said, you and I are the only two people who said then what we actually are now, and you wanted to be a writer, and I wanted to be divorced from a wealthy man. And I said, Sheila?
So who won in that one?
Well, she did it twice, so she's a lot better at it than she gave herself credit for.
I guess that's something to shoot for. Or literally shoot for.
Exactly.
Your characters are so amazing. I'm just drawn to your women especially, but all your characters. And your stories are not light. They don't slide across the surface at any point, any of the structure or anything. Nothing is easy. It's not done easy. How the heck do you do one a year?
I don't know.
Know,
it used to be easier. Just the physical act of sitting that long now, I'm like a creaky old woman when I get up. I love it so much. I just get into a zone. And there's so very few people who get to do for a living what they want to do.
Yeah.
And so I feel very fortunate in that regard.
Yeah.
And when I think about my characters, you know, I think of books and series. So even as I was working on Coptown, I was thinking of the one coming after that and the one with Will Trent that comes after that and what's happening with him and Sarah. And I'm always writing myself notes and I'm thinking of details that I think will be interesting, you know. And I mean, just today I was at a restaurant and someone used the tail of their shirt to open a bottle and I thought, boy, I bet that's a clue Sarah might find in somebody's shirt. Don't mm-hmm. you dare use it. where, you know, their shirt's torn and so she knows that he's right-handed and she knows, you know, so yeah. I thought that would, you know, so things like that are yeah. always in my mind. And I think when I think about these characters, I think about them as people I know.
Yeah, and they must be by now.
And that was a great challenge of Coptown because it is easier to write series characters mm-hmm. because you have a shorthand with them and you have all these exciting secrets about them that you want to tell people or not tell people.
Yeah.
And I love that, but I needed to challenge myself. I got bored with my Grant County books. If you know how they end, please don't tell anyone because I need to sell those books still. I don't want to be in a position where I'm doing what I could actually do, which is just sling out a book and they'd give me some money and, you know, the quality goes down and down and down. And I'm sure your guys are thinking of some of your favorite authors who have done this and you can really tell they're bored. And yeah. I want to keep challenging myself because I didn't do this so that I could get money or get famous or any of the other stuff. Not that I'm complaining about that. I did it because I love writing. And writing is something that you don't choose. It chooses you.
Yeah.
And I feel very lucky when I'm writing these books that I can do
that. How do you feel when you can't write, when you're out doing these things? How do you feel?
Actually, it's a good break for me.
Oh, good.
And I'm, you know, I write in spurts. I can't stop doing that. It worked for me when I had a real job, and now it works for me where I have a cabin in the North Georgia mountains and I go up there and I just sit down and it's just me and the characters and what I want to do in the book. And I do stay up there for 2 or 3 weeks at a time, and my father's right down the street, so he'll bring me chocolate cake and tell me to bathe. Aww. And things like that.
Aww.
Yeah.
Aww.
He takes good care of me. And you know, one thing, my dad is not a big reader. Like Will, the dyslexia runs in our family, and, and he also thinks that reading is sort of a waste of time. He doesn't understand it. He grew up very poor, and
is he kind of a mountain man? If you're up
he
there,
he sort of is. But it tickled him no end when I was a reader, and my sisters, I'm the youngest of three, are still ticked off because I'm the only one he saved money for to go to college.
Oh my god.
Because
gosh.
I was a reader. And then I dropped out of college, so he still hasn't forgiven me for that, even though he went to Vegas with the money, but whatever. but he grew up very poor, and the only entertainment was telling stories. And so they told each other stories. He had 9 brothers and sisters. His father was an awful, awful man. He was so bad at taking care of his family that the Klan kicked him out.
Yeah. Oh my God.
Who knew they had standards? Oh. That's how they kept each other company. And he was always telling us stories. And, you know, my grandmother loved telling stories on people. Gossiping is a Southern tradition. And it's considered the most rude thing you can do, but everybody wants to know what you know about everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And I was in a church last night, in Dallas for this big author series, Authors Live. I missed my plane. I wasn't very live. I was thinking about when I was little and my grandmother would take me to church. Mm-hmm. And everybody had a story. You know, she would introduce me to Mrs. Smith or Mrs. Jones. And as soon as the woman turned her back, she'd say, well, you know she's a drinker. or, you know, her husband's cheating on her. And so all my characters have these really rich backstories because, yeah. you know, I don't think of them as just, oh, the nice lady in the hat. I think, well, what's she hiding?
Yeah, right. Your grandmother gave you that.
Absolutely.
And did you have the thing of, well, bless your heart?
Absolutely.
And you knew the knife was going in
exactly.
your back?
Exactly. Yeah. Oh. Yeah. Bless your heart is a shorthand for you're really stupid and I'm making fun of you. But you have to use it the right way. My grandmother was a master of that.
Was she?
Yeah.
Did you live with your grandmother?
No, I live with my dad and my stepmother. But she visited a lot, which is why I had a stepmother instead of my mother. She was a great lady, though, and she read True Crime magazine. Do you remember that True Crime magazine?
Yeah, sure.
It's like snuff porn, and there was always a woman on the cover looking over her shoulder, terrified, and the headline said her husband was right, or, you know, she should have listened to her father, and she would have to go to the Piggly Wiggly on the back side of town to get this magazine, because they didn't sell it at our Winn-Dixie. And so every Sunday she would go to her church, which my parents didn't want me to go to because they were one generation from snake handling.
Oh.
And she would go to church, and then she would go to the Piggly Wiggly and get the True Crime magazine.
Mm-hmm.
She would go home and she would read it while she was cooking Sunday supper. And then she would hear us coming up the driveway and she would hide it under her chest of drawers. And so as soon as we got there, my sisters and I went and we looked under her chest of drawers. And our parents thought we were just awful people who were terrified of the fire and brimstone that we got at the church. But it was really the True Crime magazine that scared us that night and we couldn't sleep. But one Christmas I thought, well, what wouldn't it be great if we gave my grandmother True Crime magazine a subscription so she didn't have to go to the Piggly Wiggly?
Yeah.
And so we gave it to her, and she opened it up, and, you know, my dad explained to her what it is. It's a subscription, and she burst into tears. She wept, and she said, I do not want the postman to know I read that. And so my dad called True Crime magazine the next day to cancel it. And apparently this had happened before because they charged him a subscription price to cancel it. So he had to pay twice for her not to get it. And then she went to the store and still got it.
Typical Southern, isn't
exactly.
It? Is that what it was like in your town, the women all kind of backbiting and knowing secrets about each other?
Yes, and the men would sit there and go, you shouldn't gossip, but they wanted to hear every single word of it.
Oh, I betcha. But that's a tradition of stories, and you come from storytellers, if your grandfather or your father would sit out there and have that oral tradition. So you must have this going on in your head. You probably couldn't have avoided being a writer, could you?
Absolutely. And, you know, it's like you, I imagine, that even if someone wasn't publishing you, you'd still be writing.
Oh, you'd have to write.
Yeah.
I've been writing for years and didn't get published, and now it's different, but still. I couldn't stop writing, and my poor husband knows that I turn into the worst, I'll use the W word, witch, when I'm not writing, because there's too much going on. It's like your head's going to explode.
I'm the same way.
Once you start getting all those characters up here, it's like you've got all these people living, and oh my God.
It's true. Well, that's why I have to get away, because I'm just awful to be around, and I can't carry on a conversation.
Oh, I know. It is tough. Can you tell us how you start a book? How you get for the writers in the audience too? How do you start a book and force yourself to keep going? Because there's that point at about what, 4, 5, 6, 7 chapters when you think this is crap. I'm not going to go on with it.
Well, what I think is, oh God, it's going to be a short story. And then I get to a few more, and I'm like, oh God, it's going to be a novella. You know. It's a great honor to know that someone is going to publish your book.
Yeah, I know.
That takes probably 90% of the stress off.
Yeah.
But then you get 95% added back because they want it on a deadline.
Yeah.
And my deadline is the first of the year. So I have the busiest fall ever, that's where I do the majority of my writing. I used to feel guilty about it because I thought, oh, you're procrastinating. You should write it in January, and then you have the whole year. And it just doesn't work out that way, because that's part of my process, is thinking about the characters and what they're going to do. But a book usually starts with, do I want to do something different? Because now that I've done a standalone a couple of times, the last one turned into a series.
Yeah.
Do I want to do something like that? Do I want to talk about Will and Sarah? Do I have a story for them?
Mm-hmm.
Or I'll see a crime, and usually, you know, there's not a new way to murder someone, which is really awful because, you know, as a crime writer, you want to come up with something new. But, I wrote a book one year about women who were kidnapped and held for a year by this mm-hmm. guy. And then Fritzl in Austria was, you know, exposed, and he's got his whole family in a basement, and none of them have ever seen daylight. And you just think, I could never come up with something that awful. It just wouldn't occur to me, which I guess is why I'm not a killer.
People probably wouldn't believe you if
exactly.
you wrote that. It's just too terrible.
And I talk to police officers all the time. They always talk about cases and things, and a lot of times it is too unbelievable. I couldn't put it in a story. Mm-hmm. Or I have to change details. I change many details because I don't want to take someone's awful experience and then basically, you know,
use it
for entertainment.
Yeah.
So I take different things from different crimes, but mm-hmm. the first chapter is very important to me. Usually when I finish, if it's going to be a Will and Sarah book, when I finish writing the last book, I'll write the first chapter of the next book.
Oh, that's smart.
Well, I want the tone to be the same. Mm-hmm. And I'm aware that, unless everybody on Facebook lies, I'm aware that a lot of people will, before a new book comes out, they'll read all the past ones. Mm-hmm. And I want them to be seamless and to make sense.
Yeah.
Because that's important to me, that these readers really get what they want out of the books.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that first chapter, it's really easy because something bad happens. Mm-hmm. The hard part is figuring out, okay, well, not just who did it, but why did they do it? Because I play very fair with my readers. You always meet the bad guy. It's not the butler on the last page and, you know, with the carpet knife or whatever. So I have to be very careful to make sure every single character has some sort of story. Otherwise, you would say, well, the really developed guy we don't know much about, that must be the killer.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to hide him in plain sight. You have to find the people that people suspect. And then you have to be aware that from probably page two, there are people who are just going to know who did it. And they're going to be really happy about that, but they have to be compelled to keep reading to find out that why,
mm-hmm.
even if they think they know who did it.
Yeah.
So it's really a balancing trick, and I do have that panic of, oh, it's going to be a short story, or, you know, what do I do? And I talk to my editor, and she'll say, just kill somebody else, you know, like it's that easy. But that figuring out, you know, everybody has a great idea for a book, and they're really great ideas. That is such an easy thing to do, though.
Yeah, I know.
It's sitting down, figuring out how the characters are going to tell the story, how the plot's going to move along, how you're going to trick people, how you're going to make people care.
Yeah.
Because you can have a great plot, but if nobody cares about the characters, they're not going to read it. And, you know, you can have great characters, but no plot, and then you're not writing a thriller.
Do you get angry when they tell you, oh, I knew who it was in the second chapter?
Well, I wonder if they're being truthful. I think, okay, they probably have a good idea. Mm-hmm. But then throughout the book, maybe they were thinking, oh, maybe I'm wrong, you know. But you know, some people just do, and I'm not good at that. I don't figure it out very easily.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm not, when I read a book, I'm not trying to figure out who the person is. I'm just trying to enjoy the book, and, you know, I don't think of it in terms of a puzzle I need to figure out. I guess it's because I do that for a living. So when I want to relax and read something, then, you know, I just get angry
if they tell me they know in the second chapter. I feel I've really screwed up somewhere.
Oh, see, I don't think that.
Good.
Because you can't fool everybody.
Hmm.
And some of them are liars.
Yeah,
so
that's what I'll tell myself.
And
next
some
time.
Of them, and you can tell this, somebody will be really smug about it. Well, I figured it out, and you think, no, you didn't.
Or,
well, I have more friends than you do.
You're listening to the National Writers Series from IPR News Radio. Coming up in the second half, Karen Slaughter reads from Coptown.
Listening to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton. The National Writer Series is a year-long book festival held in the historic City Opera House in Traverse City, Michigan. We return now to Elizabeth Bazelli's conversation with novelist Karen Slaughter.
You know so much in your books. Your research just floored me. I mean, you know everything about the guns. You know everything about hospital routine. You know everything about a cop's daily routine. You know everything about everything. How the heck do you do that?
Well, I know it when I'm writing the book, but it's like the SATs. You're never going to be that smart ever again in your life.
But can't you save it to use in other books?
I did. Well, I wrote a book a couple of books ago called Criminal that took place in the 1970s. And that book started with a very clear question for me, because Will Trent has a boss named Amanda Wagner. And she's in her mid-60s, and she's just a ball breaker. And she's a police officer, and she came up in the 70s. And I thought, why is she so awful? Because we all know women like that who, you know, they when they get to the top, they pull the ladder up after them. And if they see a woman come behind them, they kind of kick them in the head.
Yeah.
And so I thought, let me really explore why she's that way. And I started talking to women police officers who started their work in the 1970s. And I thought, my God, no wonder they are so ticked off.
Yeah.
And no wonder they think women today have it so easy, because they do, comparatively speaking. And for this, for Cop Town, I spoke to them for hours about the hazing they went through. You know, they would open their locker and there was a pile of feces in there. Or they would get behind their squad car and there was some DNA samples in the squad car from the men that they had left there. And they were groped and they were pushed around. It was very physical on the part of the men, because they just thought, well, okay, if you're going to be a cop, you can't be a woman anymore, and I'm going to push you and push you and push you. Some men, as I said before, you know, power, I believe, is not taken, it's given. Mm-hmm. There were some men who said, well, okay, well, women actually are good at this job. They do know what they're doing. We mm-hmm. should give them a chance. They do have families to support just like we do. You know, they're not just here for the lark. But these women really had to put up with a lot of crap. And I remember talking to them. We were at a coffee shop, and we were laughing our asses off just at the crazy things they went through. And I got back home, and I was looking through my notes, and I thought, oh, my God, this is so horrible. They had made jokes of all of it. But, you know, one woman, her boss threw a phone at her head. And remember when phones used to be really heavy and you paid $5 a month for them? It dented the wall, but he threw it at her head because he was so mad at her, because she had told him that she wasn't going to go out with him. He was married and actually 30 years older. Another woman, she was almost raped by her boss. He drove her home from work, and out in the front of her house, he tried to rape her. And at the time, Atlanta had, and a lot of major cities had these, they weren't Black Panthers, they were sort of an offshoot, a kinder generally nonviolent offshoot, but they policed the neighborhoods, and they wore the berets and that sort of thing. And if they saw criminals, they put a stop to it. And they actually saved her from being raped by her boss.
Oh, my gosh.
And, you know, as bad as the men were, the women could be even more horrible. And, you know, when talking to these people, I realized, okay, the men and the women were horrible to the new recruits, but being a cop is not an easy thing. And Maggie even says this in the beginning of the book, when Kate, on her first day, is being hazed by the women in the locker room. You know, she's run the gauntlet through the men, and then the women just treat her like a ragamuffin and punch her around. And Maggie says if she can't handle this in the locker room, then she can't handle it in the street. And that's true.
Yeah. Oh, my heavens. Those women went through things. But that was actually in almost all professions. I mean, women,
until
they've got the right to sue and not have to live with that in their workplace.
Well, the women who sued, though, their careers were stymied. Mm-hmm. But the women who were around the women who sued, they managed to move up. All the women I spoke with who started out in these really dire situations, they retired with honors, captains, majors, with very good rank.
Wow.
One of them was a consultant during the Olympic bombing with the FBI. Mm-hmm. So they really have made amazing lives for themselves. The one thing I asked every single one of them was, why did you become a police officer? Because this was a time when, as I said, nobody wanted them to be cops, their mothers especially, because they said, no man will marry you. And even today, female police officers had a hard time finding men who aren't intimidated by the fact that she can throw them to the ground and handcuff them, not in the good way. But, you know, it was a really radical choice. We're not far removed from a time when husbands and fathers could have their daughters and wives institutionalized for being crazy and wanting rights and wanting to do things and being, you know, sexual or whatever. You know, 1972, the pill was approved legally for unmarried women. Before that, you had to prove you were married. This was a time when women were still discriminated in housing, couldn't get credit cards, couldn't get bank accounts, unless they had a man's approval. My own grandmother, when my father was 22 years old, and she finally got rid of my grandfather, she had to get my 22-year-old father to co-sign a lease for her so she could rent a house.
Or get loans or anything. They had to have a man who would sign for them.
Exactly. And so this is the world they were in. It's, I asked them, why would you do this? And to a one, they all had some variation on the answer of, because someone told me not to. I see a lot of men nodding their heads. But that's, the, you know, one woman, she went downtown. She wanted to be, she was a Kelly girl. And she wanted to be a secretary. And at the time, if you wanted to work for the government, which she did, you went to one building and you filled out an application, and then they called you back for an interview. So she went downtown, and she went into the wrong room. There was a police officer there. And he said, this is applications for the police force. And she said, okay, you know, okay. And he said, well, little lady, you don't belong here. And she said, I absolutely do. And she grabbed the application, and she sat down, and she was filling it out, and she was thinking, God, I'm going to have to come back here tomorrow. And, you know, she gave it to him, and she left, and she went home, and the phone rang, and they had called her back for an interview. And she thought, oh, God, well, they'll arrest me for wasting police time if I don't go to the interview. And surely when I get there, they'll realize I can't be a police officer. And so she went to the interview and, you know, answered all the questions and all that, and then she went home. And again, the phone rang, and they said, be at the police academy on Monday. She hadn't even told her husband. And so she went to the police academy because her husband told her not to. And she kept thinking, I'm going to wash out. You know, they're going to tell me I don't belong here. She's one of the women who consulted with the FBI eventually. But that's why she was there, because someone said she didn't belong.
You have... a lot of corrupt cops, especially in Cop Town. Do you have problems driving through Georgia?
You know, I don't. I write about Will Trent, and Will Trent is a cop, and he's a good guy. He's a good cop, and his partner Faith is, and so I do balance it out. And the fact is, corruption is more interesting to write about. People think they want to read about happiness and, you know, everybody doing what they're supposed to do. And, I mean, even the Bible has people who mess up. So there's a reason why we have to have corrupt cops in books, especially. But I'm a big proponent of supporting the police. I think they do a they do a very thankless job. They're taking their lives into their own hands, teaching. And, you know, the stories that I tell mostly come from police officers because they want to help. And when an author says, hey, I need some help, they, you know, they tell a story and they see such fascinating things and they think in such a different way. I know there's some lawyers in the room, and I know going to law school changes how, not just who you are, but how you think about things, how you look at things. That's the whole point of that, is to structure your mind in a way that thinks about the law. And for police officers, it completely changes the structure of their minds toward being police officers. And it's just amazing to me to hear their perspective on things. And some of them, you know, they're not all redneck, hillbilly, racist, blah, 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 you know. A lot of them have very liberal leanings. A lot of them have quirks and, you know, they're just normal human beings. But one thing they share is there is definitely an us versus them.
Yeah.
And I think any, you know, the military, you see that. And
oh,
there's
sure.
a reason.
It's
a teacher's, you see that. I mean, God, I would never want to be in a teacher's room when the teachers are together talking about the students.
No.
You probably never send your kids to school.
when you deal with the cops, was it hard to get them to open up at the beginning? Or were they only too happy to because they knew you were a writer?
Well, my stepmother's sister was a chief of detectives when I was growing up. Mm. And so she had a lot of interesting stories that she told. And my father is one of those good old boys in Georgia, and he knows a lot of people, and he knew the Speaker of the House for the state of Georgia, who said, oh, well, you should talk to so-and-so at the Georgia Bureau of Investigation. And I called him up, and it was the director of communications, and he said, I was hoping you would call me, because I have a Google alert for the GBI, and I keep hearing about this agent, Will Trent, and I can't find him. Oh. And they let me go on training exercises and, you know, all this stuff, and see the crime lab, which actually is kind of boring, because it's just machines. But the people there are fascinating, and you know, I'm a kind of person who says yes to everything, which got me in a lot of trouble in high school, but we won't talk about that. And we were passing by the morgue, and they said, hey, do you want to see an autopsy? And I said, yes. And then I thought, oh, no, because I had always resisted seeing an autopsy, because I thought, I don't want to take a very real, awful situation and then write about it, you know, just as some goofy crime writer, mm-hmm. right? And I quickly realized that was not possible, because it was so solemn. There wasn't the joking you always see on TV, and, you know, they were very, it was almost religious in their respect, and it was fascinating, and I think it informed my writing in a different way. Mm-hmm. And it brought home how real it is, because one thing I say, and I know there are writers in the room, and hopefully you all want to be crime writers, because that's the best writer. You have to always remember, even when you're writing very lightly about crime, that these are things that happen to people every day. You know, there are rapes, there are murders, there are rapes and rapes and rapes. All these things are happening. And you need to be aware that someone might pick up your book and take your treatment of this crime, your light treatment, and be offended by it. And so I always try to be respectful of that and remember that these are real people who have this stuff happen.
Mm-hmm. I once mentioned at a signing that I wanted to go to an autopsy, and this gentleman in all this flex stuff he had on, he kind of sidled up to me and he says, I can get you into an autopsy. And I thought, well, that was the best offer I'd had in a long, long time. And then I chickened out. I thought, oh, I'm going to go in and make a fool of myself. I'm going to hit the floor. I won't be able to do it. So you did it.
I did.
That took guts.
Well, and I had men come up and say that to me. And my first question is, are you affiliated with the coroner in any way? Or is this just something you do for a hobby? Or
Yeah.
it was difficult, but I think it was a good experience, mm-hmm. if there can be a good experience from something like that.
Yeah, but it's something of knowledge.
Yeah,
who was
exactly.
it? Michelangelo had to know what the body was mm-hmm. made of, and you almost needed that reverence, that sense of reverence to know you don't do it lightly. Most of the things around death, you try not to do lightly. They're there, and they're horrible. And you certainly portray it as horrible, but there's still the reverence there. There's still someone's going to be sorry. Someone feels horrible. Would you read something from Coptown
sure.
for us?
I'll read from the last chapter where you find out who did it.
Sure.
All right, well, how about the first chapter? It's a prologue, actually. It's not that long, I don't think. They said read for 5 minutes. If anybody gets bored, just knock on your... Dawn broke over Peachtree Street. The sun razored open the downtown corridor, slicing past the construction cranes waiting to dip into the earth and pull up skyscrapers, hotels, convention centers. Frost spiderwebbed across the parks. Fog drifted through the streets. Trees slowly straightened their spines. The wet, ripe meat of the city lurched toward the November light. The only sound was footsteps. Heavy slaps echoed between the buildings as Jimmy Lawson's police-issue boots pounded the pavement. Sweat poured from his skin. His left knee wanted to give. His body was a symphony of pain. Every muscle was a plucked piano wire. His teeth gritted like a sandblock. His heart was a snare drum. The black granite Equitable building cast a square shadow as he crossed Pryor Street. How many blocks had Jimmy gone? How many more did he have to go? Don Wesley was thrown over his shoulder like a sack of flour. Fireman's carry, harder than it looked. Jimmy's shoulder was ablaze, his spine drilled into his tailbone, his arm tripled from the effort of keeping Don's legs clamped to his chest. The man could already be dead. He wasn't moving. His head tapped into the small of Jimmy's back as he barreled down Edgewood faster than he'd ever carried the ball down the football field. He didn't know if it was Don's blood or his own sweat that was rolling down the back of his legs, pooling into his boots. He wouldn't survive this. There was no way a man could survive this. The gun had snaked around the corner. Jimmy had watched it slither past the edge of a cinder block wall. The sharp fangs of the front sights jutted up from the tip of the barrel. Raven MP25, six-round detachable box, blowback action, semi-auto. The classic Saturday night special, $25 on any ghetto corner. That's what his partner's life had come down to, $25. Jimmy faltered as he ran past First Atlanta Bank. His left knee almost touched the asphalt. Only adrenaline and fear saved him from falling. Quick bursts of recall kept setting off colorful fireworks in his head. Red shirt sleeve bunched up around a yellow gold wristwatch, black gloved hand holding the white pearl grip. The rising sun had bathed the weapon's dark steel in a bluish light. It didn't seem right that something black could have a glint to it, but the gun had almost glowed. And then the finger pulled back on the trigger. Jimmy knew the workings of a gun. The 25 slide was already racked, cartridge in the chamber. The trigger spring engaged the firing pin hit the primer ignited the gunpowder. The bullet flew from the chamber. The casing popped out of the ejection port. Don's head exploded. Jimmy's memory did no work to raise the image. The violence was etched into his corneas, backdrop every time he blinked. Jimmy was looking at Don, then he was looking at the gun, then he was looking at how the side of Don's face had distorted into the color and texture of a rotten piece of fruit. Click, click. The gun had jammed, otherwise Jimmy wouldn't be running down the street right now. He would be face down in an alley beside Don, condoms and cigarette butts and needles sticking to their skin. Gilmer Street, Cortland, Piedmont, three more blocks. His knee could hold out for three more blocks. Jimmy had never been on the business end of a firing gun. The flash was an explosion of starlight, millions of pinprick pieces of sunlight lighting up the dark alley. His eardrums rained with the sound, his eyes stung from the cordite. At the same time, he felt the splash against his skin, like hot water, only he knew it was blood and bone and pieces of flesh hitting his chest, his neck, his face. He tasted it on his tongue, crunched the bone between his teeth. Don Wesley's blood, Don Wesley's bone. Jimmy was blinded by it. When Jimmy was a kid, his mother used to make him take his sister to the pool. She was so little back then, her skinny, pale legs and arms poking out of her tiny suit reminded Jimmy of a baby praying mantis. In the water, he'd cup his hands together, tell her he'd caught a bug. She was a girl, but she loved looking at bugs. She'd paddle over to see, and Jimmy would squeeze his hands together so the water would squirt into her face. She would scream and scream. Sometimes she would cry, but he'd still do it again the next time they were in the pool. Jimmy told himself it was all right because she kept falling for it. The problem wasn't that he was cruel. The problem was that she was stupid. Where was she now? Safe in bed, he hoped, fast asleep, he prayed. She was on the job too, his little sister. It wasn't safe. Jimmy could end up carrying her through the streets one day. He could be jostling her limp body, careening around the corner, his knee brushing the blacktop as the torn ligaments clashed like cymbals. Jimmy saw a glowing sign ahead, a white field with a red cross in the center, Grady Hospital. He wanted to weep. He wanted to fall to the ground, but his burden would not lighten. If anything, Don got heavier. The last 20 yards were the hardest of Jimmy's life. A group of black men were congregating under the sign. They were dressed in bright purples and greens. Their tight pants flared below the knee, showing a touch of white patent leather. Thick sideburns, pencil mustaches, gold rings on their fingers, Cadillacs parked a few feet away. The pimps were always in front of the hospital this time of morning. They smoked skinny cigars and watched the sun rise as they waited for the girls to get patched up for the morning rush hour. None of them offered to help the two bloody police officers making their way toward the doors. They gawked. Their cigarillos stopped midair. Jimmy fell against the glass doors. Someone had forgotten to lock them. They butterflied open. His knee slewed to the side. He fell face first into the emergency waiting room. The jolt was like a bad tackle. Don's hip bone knifed into his chest. Jimmy felt the flex of his own ribs kissing his heart. He looked up. At least 50 pairs of eyes stared back. No one said a word. Somewhere in the bowels of the treatment area, a phone was ringing. The sound echoed through the barred doors. The Gradys. Over a decade of civil rights hadn't done much. The waiting room was still divided, black on one side, white on the other. Like the pimps under the sign, they all stared at Jimmy, at Don Wesley, at the river of blood flowing beneath them. Jimmy was still on top of Don. It was a lewd scene, one man on top of another, one cop on top of another. Still, Jimmy cradled his hand to Don's face, not the side that was blown open, the side that still looked like his partner. It's okay, Jimmy managed, though he knew it wasn't okay, would never be okay. It's all right. Don coughed. Jimmy's gut twisted at the sound. He'd been sure the man was dead. Get help, he told the crowd. But it was a whisper, a begging little girl's voice that came out of his own mouth. Somebody get help. Don groaned. He was trying to speak. The side of his cheek was gone. Jimmy could see his tongue lolling between shattered bone and teeth. It's okay, Jimmy's voice was high as a whistle. He looked up again. No one would meet him. There were no nurses, no doctors. No one was going to help. No one was answering the damn telephone. Don groaned again. His tongue slacked outside of his jaw. It's okay, Jimmy repeated. Tears streamed down his face. He felt sick and dizzy. It's going to be okay. Don inhaled sharply like he was surprised. He held the air in his lungs for a few seconds before finally letting out a low, baleful moan. Jimmy felt the sound vibrating in his own chest. Don's breath was sour, the smell of a soul leaving the body. The color of his flesh didn't drain so much as feel like a pitcher of cold buttermilk. His lips turned an earthly funeral blue. The fluorescent lights cut white stripes into the flat green of his irises. Jimmy felt a darkness pass through him. It gripped his throat, then slowly reached its icy fingers into his chest. He opened his mouth for air, then forced it closed for fear that Don's ghost would flow into him. Somewhere, the phone was still ringing. A raspy old woman grumbled, "Doctor ain't never gonna get to me now."
Oh, thank you. Great energy.
My pleasure.
I think we're supposed to have some questions now.
Hi, I'm Jean Ashton. I'm a novel writer, and I just finished a teaching stint down at Ferris and moved up to lovely Traverse City. And I had a question. What point in your writing process for your book do your characters get up and start taking over the story?
I think always, because I'm, you know, all the characters are me. I'm aware of that, so maybe I'm not schizophrenic. There's your answer. But I let the characters tell the story. You know, a lot of them have different opinions for me. They do things that I wouldn't necessarily do. For instance, run toward the danger as opposed to away from it. And I just have to feel confident that I know this character well enough to let them do what they need to do. I mean, it goes back to the thing between Lena and Sarah in the hallway. I know these characters aren't going to have a happily ever after. And so I have to get them to that point where they can have this sort of conflict and still be their own person and still in many ways be a likable person. Because when people fight, usually someone picks a side. And I wanted to make sure that both sides could be seen. But as far as the characters just, doing their own thing, I think that every page has that. I think that's kind of the fun of writing is being this different person. One of the things I loved when I wrote my Grant County books was I would have one character. I had a chief of police, and Lena was the detective who worked for him. And they would go to a crime scene, and then you would get his point of view. And then in the next chapter, you would get her point of view. And they were seeing the same thing, but they saw it completely different. And I love playing with that as a writer.
One more?
Can I ask a question?
Please.
Do you guys support your local library?
Sure do.
Okay, maybe we'll let you have a book.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Oh, it's just a wonderful interview.
That was Karen Slaughter at the National Writers Series, talking with Elizabeth Pizzelli. Learn more about the National Writers Series and upcoming events at nationalwritersseries.org. And listen to past programs at interlochenpublicradio.org. For IPR, I'm Linnea Melcarrick.